Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
You are listening to Perplexity.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a mystery podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's episode, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. So happy you're here. I have a special rewind collection for you guys today. I am calling this the frogging collection. I hate frogging. It scares me so much. And right now I am recovering at the time this comes out from CrimeCon. Future me is probably very exhausted because it was a nonstop weekend, but I'm sure I had so much fun. But that is why we're doing a rewind today. And I know I have a lot of new listeners, so I have a feeling that quite a few of you have probably never heard these episodes before, but I apologize in advance for the poor audio quality. This is when I did not know what I was doing, okay? But the stories are good. The quality is still listenable. So today you will be hearing the horrifying frogging nightmare stories of the Campbell family and Daniel LaPlante. I hope you guys enjoy them. And if you do, be sure to let me know. If you haven't done so yet, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you can. Continue to tell people about the show. And if you really want to support the show further, go check out the Perplexed Society for early and ad-free episodes and tons of bonus content. That's patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Trigger warning for today's episode. This is going to have some disturbing and adult content, so listener discretion is advised. So without further ado, let's get into this frogging collection.
Man, guys, buckle up. I have a crazy story for you guys today. I've actually been wanting to share this story on the podcast since I started it. And I heard this story a couple years ago. There's twists, turns, it's super creepy. Really crazy story. This story takes place in a small town in Massachusetts known as Pepperell, and it's the year 1986. Let's talk about some people. So we have 15-year-old Annie and 8-year-old Jessica Andrews, who are sisters. So this is the Andrews family. The Andrews family had recently lost their mother, unfortunately, to cancer. The mother died abruptly and unexpectedly. It seems like they knew that she had cancer, but she seemed to be doing fine, so the death was very traumatic and sudden for the family. And to lose your mom at 15 and 8 years old, that would be, you know, incredibly difficult. So Annie and Jessica are grieving. They were also very, very close to their mother. Their dad, Brian, is in the picture, but he works full-time. So especially after losing the mother, he has to work a lot. He's gone all the time. So really, Annie and Jessica are dealing with a lot of this grief by themselves, like just the two of them, because their dad's having to work so hard to make ends meet for the family. So Brian starts working extra shifts. He's a bus driver, and this would leave Annie and Jessica home alone very often, which was also very common during this time period. So one night, while Brian was out working, the girls decide that they want to try to get in contact in the spiritual realm with their mother. They really want to connect with her, and they somehow get a hold of a Ouija board. They would later admit that they didn't expect anything to happen, but they were so desperate for any sort of connection with their mother, they were willing to try anything. So Annie and Jessica went down into their basement, and they have what is considered a teenage girl's version of a seance. They light some candles, they sit in a circle, they're seeing if their mother is there, you know, asking, are you there? Can you hear us? Can you give us a sign? And this goes on for a few hours. During the seance, though, nothing happens. So eventually, the girls give up for the night. They're feeling a little bit defeated, and they put the Ouija board away. So the seance wasn't necessarily successful, but the girls did say that after the seance, they felt a little bit more at peace, and they felt more close to their mom. So it was probably a little bit therapeutic for them, just being able to sit and talk with her spirit, even if they didn't get any kind of response. The girls eventually went upstairs to their bedrooms and went to bed for the night. Brian worked really late shifts, so he still was not at home at this point. Some time passes, it's the middle of the night. Annie and Jessica are in separate bedrooms, they're both asleep. Both of the girls from their separate bedrooms start to notice a strange tapping sound. It startles them, it wakes them up, and the tapping sound seems to be coming from inside of the walls. Eventually, Jessica gets up and goes into Annie's bedroom to see if she's hearing the same thing that she is. So Jessica's like, Annie, are you hearing this too? And Annie's like, yeah, girl, I'm hearing it. What is going on? And basically, because the girls are, again, missing their mother so much, they attribute the sound to maybe the seance worked, and this is our mom trying to get in touch with us. This is great news. So out loud, Annie and Jessica start to ask questions to whatever is the source of this tapping sound. They're like, are you here with us right now? Can you show yourself to us? So later that night, Brian eventually comes home from his late shift at work, and Annie and Jessica rush out to greet their father, even though it's the middle of the night. They're so excited about this tapping noise and the seance and potentially getting into contact with their mom. So they start to tell him all about it. But at this point, Brian's worked a very long shift. He really is not listening or taking any of this seriously. He just thinks that the girls miss their mom. Annie and Jessica also mention the tapping sound to Brian as well. But again, he brushes it off and basically tells the girls, go back to bed. You're 15, you're 8 years old. It's the middle of the night. So this tapping sound would continue for several days. And each time it appeared to be coming from Annie's room inside of the walls. The tapping sound was incessant. It would go on throughout the whole day and even throughout the night. But each time that Annie and Jessica would try to get their dad and show him this tapping sound, it would stop. So after this tapping sound goes on for several days, then this poltergeist seems to ramp up. Annie and Jessica started to notice objects were being moved around the house and disappearing altogether. Furniture would move out of position, silverware had been moved around, just small things around the house. Annie and Jessica would even come home from school sometimes and see that the furniture in their bedrooms had been rearranged. At this point, now Brian is starting to notice that weird things are happening at the house as well. He's noticing items are being moved or disappearing, but again, he thinks it's just the girls acting out or grieving in some way about their mom. So Brian starts to blame the girls, like, hey, cut it out, quit moving stuff around the house. But each time that Brian would blame Annie and Jessica for this happening, the girls were insistent that this was 100% not them. At this point, Annie and Jessica also are starting to feel a little bit scared. They don't think that whatever this spirit is their mom, because why would their mom try to scare them? So Annie and Jessica start to theorize that perhaps when they messed with this Ouija board, they let out some other spirit, perhaps something more dark and sinister. One night, the girls even hear their doorbell ring, but when they run to the door, no one is there. And again, Brian was always working late, so when the doorbell rang, Brian wasn't home. He didn't get to hear it. So one evening, it's January 1987, and Annie and Jessica are hanging out together in the front room of their house. While they were home alone, Brian was out working, and the tapping sound from in the walls comes back. But this time, Annie and Jessica start to listen more and more to the tapping sound, and they realize the sound is actually not coming from inside the walls anymore. It seems like the tapping sound has moved. As they follow the sound, they follow the sound downstairs to the basement. So it's 15-year-old Annie and 8-year-old Jessica home alone hearing a tapping sound in the basement. The girls at this point have had enough of this, and that's basically what gave them the courage to go down to the basement and investigate the noise. 15-year-old Annie even grabbed a knife for self-defense before they went down the stairs. But by the time that they got down the stairs, the tapping sound stopped, and they found nothing. So Annie and Jessica are beyond frustrated and scared at this point, but again, they can't find any source for the sound in the basement, so they give up, and just when they turn around to start to leave the basement, they make a startling discovery. Annie and Jessica notice there is a strange message written on the wall next to the basement stairs. They get closer to read the message, and it appears it is written in blood. Now, there are some conflicting reports on what the message said, but some sources report the message read, quote, "Come and find me, I'm in your closet." Other sources claim that the message read, "I'm in your room, come and find me." But either way, this message is terrifying. And the girls are so freaked out, they let out a huge scream, they sprint up the stairs, and they end up bolting out of the house, running across the street to a neighbor's to get help. So Annie and Jessica tell the neighbors what happened, and they ultimately decided to stay at the neighbor's house and wait to go back into their house until their father came home from work. So the neighbors call Brian, they tell him what's happened, and he comes home to talk to the girls. The police also came, and from what I found, it's not clear if the neighbors called the police or if Brian called the police, but the police did come to investigate. Brian's initial reaction is to not believe the girls again. He still thinks that this could be them, either wanting to get more attention from him, wanting him to be home more, or it's just their way of grieving. So when the police arrive, Brian and the police go together inside of the house. They go down to the basement and they look at this written message on the wall. And this is when Brian and the officers discover that the writing is not in blood, it's written in ketchup. So Brian is super embarrassed at this point. He thinks this was a prank that Annie and Jessica did, and he's embarrassed that the police came all the way out for essentially nothing. So Brian apologizes to the officers and tells them, you know, false alarm, you can leave, I'm so sorry. Brian is pretty upset at this point, and this is when he tells Annie and Jessica that enough is enough and that they need to go to grief counseling. After this strange event in the basement, several weeks goes by and nothing seems to happen. The house is quiet. The tapping stopped, there's no more creepy messages. So Annie and Jessica are relieved, and they thought maybe the house went back to normal. But one night, while Brian is at work, the tapping sound comes back again. So Annie and Jessica get up and they creep down the hall together to find the source of the sound. As they get closer, they realize the sound is coming from upstairs where the girls' bedrooms are. So the girls creep up the stairs and eventually they enter Annie's bedroom and figure out this is where the sound is coming from. This is when the girls enter Annie's bedroom and they find a second message written on the wall. This time the message says, "I'm back, Find me if you can. This once again startles the girls to their core, and they do the same thing. They scream, they freak out, they run out of the house, run to the neighbors to get help. The neighbors call Brian. Brian comes home, and he goes to the neighbor's house. They discuss what happened, and again, Brian is angry. He doesn't understand why the girls keep doing this, and at this point, he's at his wit's end. But this time, the neighbors have seen how visibly startled Annie and Jessica are, and the neighbors basically say to Brian, "Look, they are so genuinely scared, I don't think that they could be faking this. There is something in that house." So this time, Brian says, "Okay, look, everybody stay here. I will go to the house myself, and I am going to look through that house with a fine-tooth comb, and I'm going to figure out what the hell is going on so that we can just put an end to all of this." So that's what he does. He goes to the house, he walks in the door, but the first thing that Brian sees when he walks inside is the house is in total disarray. There's broken glass, furniture is turned over, there's trash everywhere. Pictures had even been removed from the walls. And I do have a photo of what appears to be their living area in this disarrayed state, so I'll put this photo on the Instagram page as well. So Brian sees the extent of the damage, and this is when he finally realizes there's no way this could be the work of Annie and Jessica. He knows that they wouldn't vandalize the home. Brian also realizes that every television in the home has been turned on. So now, with heightened adrenaline, Brian begins to creep slowly through the home. He goes from room to room, searching for the source. He eventually searches the entire downstairs and finds nothing, so he decides to check upstairs. When Brian finally reaches the top of the stairs, he finds a photo of Annie with a knife stuck into it. Brian then finds a third message written on the wall in ketchup that says, "Marry me." So eventually, Brian reaches Annie's bedroom where the second message had been found, and he sees the message on the wall, "I'm back, find me if you can." But again, despite seeing all these crazy things and hearing all the TVs on, he's not seeing any source for this crazy phenomenon. So he turns towards his bedroom. He's going to search his bedroom next. But as he turns towards his bedroom, he hears a noise come from behind him in Annie's room. So he turns back towards Annie's bedroom, and this is when he meets the eyes of an intruder. There is someone in Annie's closet. And the more that Brian looks at this intruder, he realizes this intruder is a man dressed in women's clothing, wearing a wig and lipstick. He also realizes that this intruder is holding a hatchet. So some reports say that this intruder was not only wearing a dress, but they were wearing Brian's deceased wife's wedding dress, hence the "Marry Me" message on the wall. So Brian is obviously very startled. This catches him off guard, so he stumbles backwards, and the intruder starts to run down the hallway out of the house in an attempt to escape. Brian tries to grab the intruder to capture them, but they somehow manage to get past Brian, and this intruder seemingly vanishes. Brian can't find this guy anywhere, but eventually he composes himself and he leaves the house, goes back to the neighbor's house, and he calls 911. Brian stayed with his daughters at the neighbor's house until the police arrived. When the police arrive, they search the house top to bottom, just like Brian did, but they can't find this intruder anywhere. But the police do believe Brian's story, and they encourage Brian to take Annie and Jessica and go stay in a different place for a while. Don't stay at the house. Brian ends up taking Annie and Jessica to a relative's home to stay there for a bit until they can figure this out. This goes on for 2 weeks, and Brian continues to wonder how this intruder could have possibly gotten away. They were in a very distinct outfit. It was broad daylight when this happened, so how could they have gotten away with nobody seeing them? The police are also not coming up with any type of leads, so the investigation is at a total standstill. After 2 weeks, Brian makes the difficult decision to bring Annie and Jessica back to the house. They decide to move back in. Brian decides that once they get back to the house, they'll get a new security system, they'll make sure that everything is constantly locked. So they're basically putting this safety plan together. The day that Brian decides to go back to the house, he has Annie and Jessica in the car. They drive there and pull up into the driveway, but Brian notices there is a light on the second floor. And Brian is absolutely positive he didn't leave any lights on in the house. So he rationalizes it and thinks, well, maybe the police were investigating and accidentally left a light on. But then Brian sees the same intruder from before dart by one of the windows. So Brian immediately stops what he's doing and calls the police again. The police are at the house within minutes, and this is when Brian finds out that law enforcement had not been in the house since the incident. They had even locked the house up, and they had been monitoring it to see if anyone would return. So the police enter the house, and again, they find the house in total disarray. And they also find something really strange. Someone has taken dozens and dozens of pennies, like the coin, and glued them all over the walls and ceilings of the Andrews family home. This intruder has also left some more disturbing messages to read all over the walls of the house. But one thing the police still haven't found, which is probably the most important thing, is this terrifying intruder. Eventually, though, the police go into, some sources say it's Annie's bedroom, some people say it's like a washer-dryer area, so I'm just gonna say they went into one room of the house, and they notice that there is a gap between the wall and a built-in cabinet. So they pull the cabinet away from the wall, and this is where they find a crawl space. So the police go inside of this tiny crawl space, and they find evidence that something had burrowed itself in the insulation of this crawl space. Not only this, but they find clothing from the girls, Annie and Jessica, that had gone missing. So they find their clothes down there, and their clothing had appeared to have been ejaculated on. Yeah. They find more written messages. They find beer cans. So clearly, someone has been living down here. There are also peepholes drilled throughout various parts of the crawl space so that you could see into each room and watch Annie and Jessica and Brian at all hours of the day. And finally, the police find the intruder. And it turns out to be a deranged teenager named Daniel LaPlante. So, after you've wrapped your head around that, we need to talk about Daniel LaPlante. So who the hell is this creepy teenager? Well, I would love to tell you. So Daniel, who went by Danny, was born in 1970 in Townsend, Massachusetts. He had a long history of abuse physical, mental, and sexual abuse as a child, primarily at the hands of his father. He also allegedly had been molested by a psychiatrist when he was an adolescent. And during his childhood, he was also diagnosed with learning disabilities, such as dyslexia and hyperactivity disorder. He also didn't receive any type of services or accommodations for his disorders in school. Danny had a very difficult time socializing and making friends. He was very withdrawn, and the peers at his school often called him creepy and weird. When Danny grew up to be a teenager, he became a petty thief, and he also began to enjoy breaking in to people's homes and trashing them. So it turns out that one day, a couple weeks before all of this creepy tapping started, Danny got the phone number for the Andrews family home. So he calls the house, and 15-year-old Annie answered the phone. Danny was Annie's age, 15 years old, and Danny claimed to be the child of one of their neighbors. He said he got their number from mutual friends. It sounds like he was also able to charm Annie over the phone. He even described his physical features to Annie, saying that he was well-built. He made himself out to basically be an attractive and athletic guy. He also told Annie that he was tall and blonde. So Annie and Danny talked on the phone for a while, and eventually Danny asked her out on a date. And Annie agreed, but when Danny showed up to her doorstep, she was greeted by someone who did not match the description that was given to her on the phone. According to an article from The Cinemaholic, Danny was, quote, dressed shabbily, looked unhygienic, and spoke in a manner that contradicted the boy on the phone in every way. He also had dark hair, acne, and just appeared to be disheveled. Daniel LaPlante was an OG catfish, but Annie was a nice girl, and she kind of felt bad. She still wanted to give Danny a chance. So she still agreed to go on the date with him. But during the date, Danny was very odd. At one point, he started asking Annie a lot of inappropriate questions about her recently deceased mother, to the point where he started asking Annie how to describe how her mom suffered and what her final moments were like. So the date didn't go well, and Annie was very upset, very disturbed. She ended the date and she stopped talking to him. So it turns out that same day, Danny followed Annie back to the home without her knowing, and he eventually found his way into the Andrews family crawl space. Danny had been living in their walls, listening to their conversations, and he had heard about Annie and Jessica being upset and dealing with their grief of their mother passing away. He would, you know, hear their conversations about it. Then he heard them play with the Ouija board, and this ultimately gave him an idea. He saw an opportunity for him to then be able to interact with Annie more. Police would later estimate that Danny had been living in their walls for months without them knowing. There were also some sources I found that claimed that Daniel LaPlante had done something similar to another family. They said that he held a family hostage, a man and his three daughters, in their home in 1986, the same year that this occurred. And this was supposedly during the same time that he was living in the Andrews family's walls. So if this is true, he wasn't just staying there all the time. He was kind of transient and disturbing other people. And this makes sense because he would have to come and go to get food and whatnot. So maybe while he was out, he was disturbing other families. It's also alleged that at one point he lived in the walls of another family's home in Pepperell, and the family ended up having to climb out of a bedroom window to escape from him. But again, the stories of those other two families are alleged. I found some sources about that, but it's not completely backed up. So after this whole ordeal with the Andrews family, Daniel was caught and arrested. He was evaluated at a psychiatric hospital before he was put into a juvenile detention center. But he was eventually released from the detention center that same year, October 1987. Danny was granted bail once the prosecutor had decided that he would be tried as an adult. So his mother came up with the $10,000 bail, which, where has his mother been the entire time? I'm sorry, you lived in this family's home for months and you have a mom that bails you out of jail? I'm very confused. But anyway, somehow he gets bailed out by his mom, and Daniel was given a December 1987 court date. But while Daniel was out on bail, he quickly slipped back into his old creepy habits. He returns to robbing houses, and during this time, the Andrews family moved away. So it's December 1st, 1987, and Daniel leaves his mom's house carrying guns that he had recently stolen from a neighbor's house. Daniel heads towards the woods, and he hikes for about a mile until he comes upon a house. This house is in Townsend, Massachusetts, and police would later say that it wasn't completely clear if he broke into the home and just got caught robbing it by the family, or if he had plans prior to harm the inhabitants all along. But the police would later find ties that he had used as restraints. So I personally think that's pretty clear. I think this whole event was premeditated. So the house that Daniel LaPlante has stumbled upon is the home of the Gustafson family. Inside the home at the time of the incident was 33-year-old Priscilla Gustafson, a pregnant nursery school teacher, and her two children, 7-year-old Abigail and 5-year-old William. Her husband Andrew was away for the day at work. And before I go any further, I want to say trigger warning for sexual assault and violence, okay? So Daniel ends up catching Priscilla by surprise, and he took Priscilla to the master bedroom, and this is where he raped her and shot her twice at point blank range in the head. He then placed a pillow over her head. I'm not sure if this was to suffocate her or if this was a sign of remorse. But after he does this, he then lured Abigail and William into separate bathtubs and drowned them both. William was found with his body face down in the tub of the upstairs bathroom, while Abigail's body was found face down in the tub in the downstairs bathroom. Abigail had also suffered blunt trauma to the head and compression of her neck. Unfortunately, it was the husband, Andrew Gustafson, who would find their bodies. So Andrew later came home from work and made this horrific discovery, the worst thing you could ever come home to in your life. And at this point, Daniel has fled the Gustafson house and he's gone back to the woods. He is in hiding. Police arrived at the Gustafson family home and they investigated and found 22 caliber gun casings. And the police actually suspect Danny very quickly. So I'm wondering what all they knew about that he had been doing in this area. But it's also a small town, so he was probably able to be narrowed down as a suspect pretty quickly. And they know Danny's on bail, so they go to check his residence and they realize he's missing. So the police put a task force together to find this creepy piece of shit. Somehow the police get a tip that Danny was hiding in a lumber yard. So eventually they find him in this lumber yard, hiding in a shed. And this is a few days after the murders of the Gustafson family. So Daniel LaPlante was arrested, and the entire time that he was being handcuffed, put in the car, and taken to the police station, he was laughing. Daniel LaPlante was booked and stripped, and they found a loaded gun stuffed in his crotch. And he was later tried as an adult and found guilty in 1988. He was sentenced to 3 consecutive terms of life in prison with the possibility of parole in 45 years. Judge Robert A. Barton told LaPlante, quote, "There are some who would say that you should receive the same sentence that you imposed on the Gustafson family. That is death by ligature or hanging." But the judge also noted that since there was no death penalty in Massachusetts at that time, the life sentence was the harshest punishment that he could impose. But I still don't understand how parole is even an option for something like this. The only thing that I can think is because he was so young, but again, they tried him as an adult. It's just crazy. So in 2013, Daniel LaPlante actually sued the state of Massachusetts for allegedly denying him access to necessary supplies for his practice of Wicca. And LaPlante claimed to be a devout Wiccan and said that the state refused to supply him with, quote, 30 essential oils and 26 herbs that he needed for his religious practice. Dragon's blood, black opium, and honeysuckle were just a few of the materials he said were necessary in order to ward off jinxes and connect with goddesses. Local practitioners of Wicca at the time were basically like, no, we don't associate with this guy. Get him the hell away from us, put him over here. No, he's not one of us. at all. And they also said that the materials he was asking for were completely unnecessary. In 2014, Andrew Gustafson, the husband, passed away. Some sources say that he pleaded on his deathbed with his loved ones to make sure that Daniel LaPlante was never released from prison. So in 2017, Daniel LaPlante sought early parole, but he was denied. And during his court appearance, he stated, quote, "Words cannot fully capture what I have done. I murdered 3 innocent people. Because of me, a 5-year-old boy will never turn 6. There's a 7-year-old girl who will never turn 8. Because of me, a woman will never be able to give birth to her 3rd child. I robbed an unborn child of his first breath. A husband was never able, again, to hear from his family, 'I love you.' I do not have the words to fully express my profound sorrow, but I am truly sorry for the harm I have caused. From the very essence of who I am, from the depth of my soul, I am sorry." End quote. Now, despite this plea, Daniel had met with many psychiatrists, and all of the psychiatrists concluded that he showed no signs of remorse, no emotions or feelings. So in my personal opinion, this little pity cry for empathy or sympathy, whatever, is bullshit. So heavily influenced by the findings from multiple psychological evaluations, Daniel's plea was denied. He then made another request for early parole, but was denied again in June of 2019. Daniel will be eligible for parole again in 2032, which would put him at around 62 years old. Let's hope this guy never gets out again. Sleep tight, Massachusetts! And, guys, if you have a room that you don't use very often, or if you have a crawl space, you know, an attic, a basement, check those spaces every so often. There is a phenomenon called frogging, P-H-R-O-G-G-I-N-G. And if you've never heard of frogging, look it up. And be aware, people sometimes like to live in other people's houses without them knowing. And it's called frogging because they hop from home to home. So this is a real thing, and it's still going on to this day. Very, very terrifying. So, yeah, check those spaces, everybody.
Today, we are going to be going to the beautiful and scenic Hawaii. But this is not going to be a scenic vacation. Sorry, everybody. Instead, today, we will be hearing the horrifying story of the Campbell family. Our central people to this story are James and Brittany. These two first met in high school, but they would later reconnect as adults and start dating. James had two sons that were around preteen age from a previous marriage when he reconnected with Brittany. And James and Brittany developed a strong connection. Brittany became like a mother to James's two boys, and soon the two of them got married in Vegas in 2018. And they became Mr. and Mrs. Campbell. They were both in their mid-30s at the time, and soon after getting married, the Campbells actually relocated to Hawaii in 2019. And this was because James was stationed in the Navy there. So the Campbell family, along with their cat and new puppy, settled into this new, suburban, beautiful two-story home in Honolulu, Hawaii. Sounds great, right? But not long after moving in, Brittany begins to notice strange things are happening here. They're not even unpacked or settled, and things are already getting creepy. So one day, Brittany walks into the garage, and she finds all of their moving boxes are tipped over. They're still in the process of unpacking. So all of the family's belongings that were in these boxes are strewn all over the garage, including very expensive music equipment because James was also a musician. And Brittany's obviously very confused by this. It didn't make sense for anyone in the family to do this. James's kids were respectful of all of their property. And like most of these stories, from what we know, Brittany would eventually let this go and just try not to think much about it, as strange as it was. A few days later, Brittany was alone in the house and she heard the front door suddenly slam. At the time, she was upstairs watching a video on her laptop and doing her makeup. She liked to sit at the desk and watch makeup tutorials while she would put her makeup on every day, something that I've definitely done before. And she knew that no one was supposed to be home at this time, so when she hears the door suddenly slam, she's understandably freaked out. She investigates around the house, and she's also calling out for James and the boys, but she finds absolutely nothing. Later the same night, James and Brittany laid down for bed, and they both heard the front door slam. And so James is like, I just locked the front door. This doesn't make any sense. So Brittany tells James about the front door slamming that morning as well, and she goes downstairs to investigate once again. She finds that the front door is unlocked. So her and James started arguing about how there's no way that he actually locked the front door, but James is certain that he did. And this sounds like a common argument that couples have all the time. So far, it's understandable, in my opinion, that they're just chalking these things up to simple mistakes each other made, or just random little things going wrong around the house, like, oh, this box may have gotten kicked over by the cat, or, oh, you just forgot to lock the front door, or maybe there was a draft and it caused the door to slam. But eventually, they went to bed, they kind of forgot about it, and James has narcolepsy, so once he's out for the night. But I'm sure that Brittany had some trouble sleeping that night. Things around the Campbell home started getting creepier and creepier. Another night, Brittany and James heard the sliding glass door in their living room mysteriously, loudly open and shut. And again, James swears that he locked this door. This time, it would be James who would go up to investigate the noise. So he finds the sliding glass door is not only unlocked,
but the screen door that is in front of the glass is also wide open. There have been several points over the last several weeks also where the dog would start to bark, and it wouldn't just be like a bark as cars are passing by. It was like an alarming, disturbed bark that their dog would make. And it would be for seemingly no reason at all. So now it's getting to the point that Brittany and James are both noticing these things, and they can't find any explanation for it. But James seems like he's a pretty level-headed, rational, you know, logical man, and he's understandably trying to keep Brittany calm. Brittany, on the other hand, which would totally be me, is getting very worried. She had a gut feeling that something dark and sinister was going on inside their new home. So a few more weeks pass, and one night, James is downstairs playing his piano, and he gets this sudden feeling like he's being watched. This is when he sees a shadowy figure standing outside their window in the living room. But when he goes to quickly investigate, the figure has vanished. Another day, James is home alone with the boys, and he noticed a note written on their family calendar that read, quote, "Your rehabilitation starts today. Do as I did. Choose a house, clean it up, set up all devices," end quote. So James is obviously confused by this cryptic note, but he thinks at the time that maybe Brittany was just messing around with him, and this is her clever way of implying, like, okay, James, clean up the house. So James actually cleaned up the house, and he didn't even mention the note to Brittany. Another night, the Campbells decided that they were gonna have a family night out after all that hard work unpacking, and they wanted to spend some time together to go see a movie. So Brittany liked taking a blanket with her when she went to the movies so she could kind of snuggle up and be comfortable. So there was this blanket that always sat on the couch, you know, like your couch blanket, and she wanted to take that particular blanket to the movies with her. So she goes to the couch and she can't find the blanket. It's gone. So she's like looking around between the cushions and, you know, kind of looking around the room, and she's like, James, did you move my blanket? And James is swearing up and down that he didn't. He's like, no, why would I touch your blanket? And so then at this point, with all the little things that have happened, I think Brittany might have been like frustrated. So she asks the boys, you know, she's like, come on, guys, like, I know you did something with this blanket. Where is it? Because it was always on the couch. She never moved it. And the boys are swearing that they did not move this blanket. So Brittany, kind of exasperated, is just like, okay, fine, whatever, let's just go. So she kind of gives up at the moment, and they all go to the movies together. So at this point, doors have been slamming, things are getting moved around, weird notes are appearing in their house, and figures are being seen outside the window. Like, what in the poltergeist is happening here? It's getting harder and harder to rationalize these things, so it makes sense that Brittany was feeling like she was being pranked. But James and the boys continued to swear that they had no idea what was going on. So what could she do? So like I said, they go to the movies, a few hours later they return, and Brittany walks inside and approaches the couch and finds her blanket. And not only is the blanket sitting on the couch, but it is neatly folded sitting on the couch, which just gives me chills up and down my body thinking about. There's something extra creepy about it just being like neatly folded there, you know? Like it's not under the couch or between the cushions where she could have missed it. So Brittany shows this to James, and now they are both convinced that there is something really fucked up going on at their house. But again, the Campbells don't have any tangible proof as to what's happening. So they don't know if the house is haunted, they don't know if they're in danger, and once again, life just kind of continues as it would for anyone. So on Friday, September the 13th, 2019, yes, Friday the 13th, the family headed out to the mainland to visit their family for a week's long vacation. They left and they saw their family. Everything was fine. It was a nice little time away. The week ends and they fly back home. They arrived to their suburban home in Honolulu, pulled into the driveway, and it's September 20th. Brittany and James see James's really nice bike just sitting in the middle of the driveway. So Brittany asked James if he used the bike and left it sitting out. And James is like, no, I definitely didn't use that. And also, it's a really expensive bike. I would not have left that out, but I didn't use it anyway. So they had no idea why it would be laying out. And he hadn't ridden it for a long time. So James and Brittany are getting this really creepy feeling. They have this gut feeling in their stomach that something is wrong. And at that moment, they just kind of look at each other. And everything's adding up. All the signs are pointing to wrong. This is really bad. So James gets out of the car and he decides he's going to check out the garage. So he opens the garage and it is completely trashed. Similar to when Brittany first found things strewn all over the garage. But the moving boxes, their belongings, it looks like they've just been thrown around as if a tornado went through there. So, and this would be my first thought, James's first instinct is they've been robbed, and he doesn't know if anyone could still be in the house at this point, so he looks around the garage for the first thing he can find, some type of weapon, and he finds a sledgehammer. So James picks up the sledgehammer, and he slowly approaches their front door. He tells Brittany and the kids to stay put, and he's gonna go investigate. So he walks up to the door, and he puts his key in the lock. But when he tries to turn the knob, he can't. The key is staying in a fixed position. The knob won't move. So at this point, he is just pushing on the door. He's pushing and pushing and pushing, and he cannot get it to open. But eventually, he pushes hard enough, and he gets the door to open just a crack. And when the door becomes slightly ajar, he meets the eyes of an intruder. And I would absolutely be shitting myself at this point. But James is holding his own. He's got the sledgehammer and he's looking at this mysterious intruder face to face. He's like, what the fuck is up, man? But the intruder speaks to James in a very calm voice. This person said to James, this is not your house. You've got the wrong house. And Brittany sees all of this happening. So she is freaking out, which I'd be doing the exact same thing. And she's screaming. She immediately starts to call the police. James also starts screaming. So things are clearly escalating. And he's like, get the hell out of my house, to this intruder. But the intruder just stays calm and continues to claim, this isn't your house. And so James and this intruder are just yelling back and forth at each other. And at this point, they're both like pushing and pulling on the door. But eventually James gets the door open wide enough to grab this creep. And so he grabs the intruder and throws him onto the front yard. And he's of course interrogating this intruder. And he's got the sledgehammer in his hand. And he's like, who are you? Why the hell are you here? What do you want with us? What makes you think you can come into our house? So the intruder is cowering in the grass and he looks pretty young, maybe in his early 20s. And he starts talking to James saying he didn't have anywhere else to go. So for a moment, maybe James felt some empathy for this guy. You know, he doesn't know if he is a squatter, if he's down on his luck and doesn't have a home. He also isn't sure if this guy could be strung out. And then he notices that this guy is wearing his clothes. Like he went into James's closet and put his clothes on. So he's kind of just taking all of this in and he's waiting for the police to arrive. After the Campbells have had some time to process, Brittany realized that their cat has been in the house the whole time that they were visiting the family. So Brittany's immediately concerned. And she starts talking to this intruder. She's like, where is my cat? But he explains to her, the cat is fine. He said he took care of the cat while they were gone. So she ran inside to check on him. and she found James' instruments, his musical instruments, laying out all over the living room. And she would later say it looked like they were laid out in like this precise, methodical way, almost like someone was taking inventory of them. She then found the cat, unharmed, but he was inside of the puppy's crate and he had no water. And she also found that this intruder must have been feeding the cat dried apricots. So I Googled this, and if you remove the stems, seeds, and leaves from apricots, they're safe for cats to eat, whether they're raw or dried. But still, it seems like a very random thing to feed an animal. And also, this guy is just a fucking creep, so. The police would then arrive and arrest this mysterious intruder, and an investigation would begin. So from what you're hearing so far, this sounds like a case of frogging. Like one of the stories that I've told on this podcast before, the case of Daniel LaPlante. He lived in this family's wall for months without them knowing. And if you think about the Campbell family, you know, things going missing, the blanket neatly folded, doors slamming and stuff. It sounds like this guy was frogging in their house, which is already terrifying. But there is much more to this story. Just wait. So this man, this intruder, was soon identified as 23-year-old Ezekiel Zayas, and he was a man from Bridgeport, Connecticut. I don't know what brought him to Hawaii, but Ezekiel was frogging. And like I've said on this podcast before, frogging is a terrifying and pretty common phenomena where people live in people's homes without them knowing. And it's called frogging because, like a frog jumps from lily pad to lily pad, these people jump from home to home so that they're not caught. People's crawl spaces, attics, guest rooms that are not used very often, those are like risky places where these froggers can sneak in. So talk about a major invasion of privacy. Zayas had been living in the crawl space of the Campbell's family attic, which is exactly what happened in the Daniel LaPlante case. He came in through their crawl space. He had been living there for months, and police weren't exactly sure how Zayas snuck his way in, but this would obviously explain, you know, all the weird shit, like I said, that had been going on at the house. But when the Campbells and police searched the home, they would find something so disturbing that it would haunt the Campbell family forever and cause them to flee Hawaii. So they searched from room to room. They found belongings everywhere. It was like a burglary, you know, everything was completely trashed, except for the boys' room. The boys' room was very neat and tidy, almost as if someone had come in and cleaned. Everything was in place and pristine, their beds were made, and someone had even done the boys' laundry. So eventually, they would reach Brittany and James's bedroom. And this is where they would find a towel neatly placed on their bed. And on the towel was a row of knives. Next to the knives was the Campbell's old laptop. So Brittany starts poking around on this laptop, which, again, something that I would totally do. And she finds this typed document. The document was titled The Omnivore Trials, The Transformation Process, A Rehabilitation for Rat-like People. So when I read this, I was like, what the fuck? And this was a typed journal that Zayas had been keeping. He like stole their old laptop and was typing his weird, freaky thought process on it for the last several months. So this is when you can start to get into this guy's psyche. The entries were incredibly detailed and gave very private insight into the Campbells. These were things that only the Campbells or someone living in the house could have known or heard. One of the entries even talked about how Brittany should stop trying to have more children and just put her focus into her two sons. And she had been getting fertility treatments. This was something, though, that her and James had only talked about to each other. So this was a secret within the family. There were also detailed profiles on each family member that Zayas had written. He even knew medical information about each of them. And then Brittany finds a detailed plan in one of the journal entries that explained the tools that Zayas would require to turn the Campbell family from omnivores to what he called Ezekiels. Ezekiel Zayas had detailed plans to drug the Campbells and perform surgeries on Brittany and the boys, including sexual reconstruction and a hand transplant. Like, I just feel sick talking about this. After looking into the search history on the laptop, it was found that Zayas had been researching surgical tables that he could buy. He was also looking at how to surgically remove an arm and how to perform gender reassignment surgery. So at this point, if you weren't already, you're probably thinking like me, what the actual fuck is going on in this deranged person's mind? Small serum bottles were also found around the house, so maybe this is where he was going to put the drugs that he used, that he was planning to use on Brittany and the boys. The laptop that Brittany regularly used was on her desk, and it had the webcam light turned on. So it turned out Brittany had noticed at random times for the last several months that the webcam light on her laptop was turning on and off in the middle of the night. Brittany would later find several video files on her laptop of Ezekiel. So she watches these videos, and Ezekiel is sitting at her desk, naked, and he starts to speak about how he could transform himself into a different person with the power of makeup. In another video, he also appeared to be mocking Brittany, making a deranged makeup tutorial since she liked to watch makeup videos and do her makeup. So Zayas would later be charged with felon burglary, but after just a few days, he was granted supervised release. The Campbells are obviously furious and horrified at this because this guy is clearly dangerous. He had plans to harm and probably murder this family. He was soon arrested again, though, after all of this happened because he burglarized and vandalized a Buddhist center, and he was imprisoned. And in August of 2020, he actually murdered his 62-year-old cellmate, a man named Vance Grace. The attack was unprovoked, and he is said to have beat Grace to death with his own hands and stomped on his head. Zayas was then placed in a Hawaii State hospital awaiting trial for this murder. So at first he was found unfit to proceed with the trial, but he was eventually deemed fit. So I guess they just kept giving these competency exams. And doctors who evaluated Zayas found an extreme callousness towards his victims and an extreme lack of remorse. They also concluded he posed an extremely high risk for future violence. This summer, so this just happened, Ezekiel Zayas pled guilty to first-degree burglary as part of a plea deal, and he was later sentenced to 40 years on four separate criminal convictions. He received 20 years in prison for manslaughter, 10 years for first-degree burglary, and 5 years for second-degree burglary, and another 5 years for second-degree assault. The sentences are to run consecutively for a 40-year sentence, so this is all obviously incredibly recent. Like I said, this is still a developing story, but I'll tell you what I know. James Campbell is currently working on a memoir called The Omnivore Trials, including more details of this case that he wants to get out to the public eye. He's had to sit on a lot of these details waiting for the trial, but there's apparently much, much more to this story. And now that the trial has happened, you know, he was on trial for this murder of his cellmate, I'm hoping that the book can come out soon. James Campbell also has a TikTok where he has shed more light about his horrifying experience and his family's experience. In one of the videos, he talks about Zayas and how he was part of some weird cult. In another video, he talked about how a female called their house soon after Zayas was arrested, and this female demanded to speak to their little boys. So James believes that this woman could have been part of the same cult that Ezekiel Zayas was in. So obviously now, it's like the danger potentially isn't over for the Campbells. What if this cult is out to get them, you know? So I can't imagine what they've been going through. It's so horrifying to think about. So the Campbells have understandably left Hawaii. They relocated to another state. Brittany was later quoted in an interview saying to the Post, "This is an incident that has really affected us psychologically as a family. It has uprooted our entire lives. Recovering from this has been really difficult." So James wants this story to get out to as many people as possible. He wants people to be aware of the dangers of frogging because it's something that can unfortunately happen to pretty much anybody, especially if you have a big house or an area of your home that you don't use very often. And there's actually a Lifetime special called Frogging that you can watch. So it's Frogging Hider in My House. And it mentions this story of the Campbells. So James Campbell's book isn't out yet, but I am patiently waiting for it. So everyone, be on the lookout for the Omnivore Trials. And that, everybody, is the absolutely horrifying story of this Hawaii House of Horrors, Ezekiel Zayas, and the Campbell family.
I hope you guys enjoyed this frogging collection, this special rewind episode. We will be back to our normal episodes soon, and I'm just so excited. We're about to get into spooky season, and you guys have no idea. I have so many exciting things coming for you guys. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to let me know. Drop a comment on Spotify. If you are listening on YouTube, you can like this video and subscribe. Sorry, there was no video today. We'll be back to videos soon. And if you have not done so yet, please leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening, because that is extremely helpful, helps me get new listeners, boosts me up the algorithm. So that is much appreciated. And be sure to go check out The Perplexed Society. You get your episodes 2 days early, you get them ad-free, and you're gonna unlock tons and tons of bonus content. So many things going on over there. And that helps me keep this show up and running. The Patreon is, by and large, how I am able to keep this going, because I don't make much of anything doing this. But even if you can't do that, even if you are just listening, I love you so much. You guys are awesome. And I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe. And I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast. Hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brannon. Assistant producer is TJ McRae. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by leaving a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really is the best way to support. Have a topic request or a perplexing story of your own you'd like to share? Send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to support the show further and unlock exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Perplexity merch and additional support links can be found in the episode description. Until next week, stay curious.